Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
If you're listening to this, congratulations. Night has fallen on the desert and you have made it through the summer solstice, which is not celebrated too much in the desert. I wonder why. The good news is that we are halfway to winter solstice and only 3 months and change till Halloween. But summertime can be beautiful, especially the summer nights and the high desert, when you can still sit outside at night, when you can open the windows all night. Just make sure you close them very early in the morning, unless you live in one of those old adobes like in New Mexico. Then you can sleep in for a little bit. Last night it got down to about 65 where I'm at, and it just feels fantastic when there's a breeze bringing it inside. Turn off all those machines, the fan, the swamp cooler, the infernal air conditioner that makes the roof rumble. And also makes you broke at the end of the month, or beginning of the month, all summer long. But the full moon sure looks pretty when it's hanging low on a summer night, and it's always good to see the bats dive bombing the bugs at dusk, and to see the weird nightjar birds with their enormous frog mouths hopping around the sandy wash like toads. But the best thing to do on a hot summer day in the Mojave, experts say, is to sleep through the hottest parts. From about noon till sundown, generally speaking, so you can enjoy the evenings, which will now start to get a little bit longer. Now, I realize there are people out there who actively enjoy summer in the Mojave, and there's nothing wrong with it. I know a lot of such people. And they do like to make it known. They love the triple digits, and that's fine, especially if you also know your human limitations. I keep reading about people being found dead on Greek islands, tourists who went for a hike, a walk. It's real hot in Greece lately in the Mediterranean. Hotter every summer, they say, and people do feel the need to maximize their limited vacation time, limited by both time and budget. But 100 degrees plus in any language is about 38 degrees Celsius. Well, that's too hot for a tourist to take a long midday walk. Yes, there are people who do it. There are people who've been doing it their whole lives, and they occasionally keel over dead too, but it's the visitor who most often succumbs. So if you're having a holiday in a hot place this weekend, whether you drove out to the desert from the coast or flew in a big jet airplane pouring more carbon into the overburdened atmosphere to a holiday island, spend the hottest part of the day taking it easy. is the swimming pool, if there's one nearby, and let the wonders of evaporation keep you cool. Nothing better than getting the shivers while you're sitting in the shade after coming out of the water. It's midsummer. Midsummer sounds so romantic, doesn't it? But I've lived a lot of places, and midsummer has rarely been the most pleasant part of the year, but these places have names such as New Orleans, and South Phoenix, and Joshua Tree. Little chance of encountering Puck in a shady grove on the river's edge in my part of the Mojave. And there's no running water at all beyond a few canyon seats that quickly fade into the sandy soil. I have had many strange encounters on desert nights, but they are of different shape and character out here. Befitting a harsh land of angular mountains and shimmering sandy playas, our fairy circles are the flattened brush around a mutilated range cow. And our fairy lights are harsh like Klieg arcs, jerkily searching the desert ground, born of a dark geometric shape above, impossible to pick out against the night sky. Searching for what? I don't think for anything in particular, but they've seen our machines do it, and these spirits always take a form familiar to the locals, familiar and regionally important. Wild Irish warlords mounted on fine horses galloping across a Galway seashore at dusk, vanishing into the sea mist. Or more in line with the sinister black triangles of the American Southwest, there is the Pooka, from which Shakespeare named his Puck.
Desert Oracle Radio.
But Puck is somewhat unlike the Pooka of the old Britons, the Welsh and the Scots and the Irish, the people of the Isle of Man and the Channel Islands. Puck is a Robin Goodfellow type, generally portrayed as an impish fellow with a generally cheerful face and sparkling eyes. It is impossible to overstate the importance of Robin Goodfellow, the attentive supernatural creature of every rural home. He was the protagonist of May Day and Midsummer celebrations for many centuries before he was slowly replaced by the semi-historical Robin Hood the Outlaw. Robin Goodfellow is the common English version of the Cornish Pixies, the Corrigans of Brittany, the House Elf, if you will. Ben Jonson wrote these lines about Robin Goodfellow, published in the year 1625. sometimes I meet them like a man, sometimes an ox, sometimes a hound, and to a horse I turn me can. Well, such is Fairyland, where every rule is regularly ignored, overturned, inverted. The puka is like our flying saucer spirits, a shapeshifter. Or, more accurately, it is without permanent shape, but takes form as one of several menacing, shadowy figures. The immense black horse. The oversized catshe. Also black in color, but for a slash of white upon its chest. A black goat, or a goblin, or even a herd of tiny black pigs. As described in the Manx chapter of the fairy faith in Celtic countries, with this anecdote coming from the Reverend Canon Cooley. Among the old people of this parish, there is still a belief in fairies. About 18 years ago, I buried a man, a staunch Methodist, who said he once saw the road full of fairies in the form of little black pigs. And that when he addressed them in the name of God, "What are ye?" they immediately vanished. He was certain that they were the fairies. And of these black, shadowy figures, there is something as true with the puka as it is true with the big, hairy monsters of North America. The glowing eyes. But you know Puck from A Midsummer Night's Dream, alias Robin Goodfellow. Although he retains his puckish, impish form throughout the play, he too can shapeshift, boasting that he easily becomes a fat and bean-fed horse or a roasted crab in a gossip's bowl. Meaning a baked crab apple, delicious when added to ale or spiced wine, which you drank from a bowl. He could become a vanishing footstool that sends a gloomy woman tumbling to the floor. That makes him laugh. Says Puck, "Fairy, thou speakest aright. I am the merry wanderer of the night." One of Puck's most charming midsummer appearances in works of literature that are not Shakespeare is in Kipling's Puck of Pook's Hill. The children were at the theater, acting to three cows as much as they could remember of Midsummer Night's Dream. Their father had made them a small play out of the big Shakespeare one, and they had rehearsed it with him and with their mother till they could say it by heart. They began where Nick Bottom the Weaver comes out of the bushes with a donkey's head on his shoulder and finds Titania, Queen of the Fairies, asleep. Then they skip to the part where Bottom asks three little fairies to scratch his head and bring him honey. And they ended where he falls asleep in Titania's arms. Dan was Puck and Nick Bottom, as well as all three fairies. He wore a pointy-eared cloth cap for Puck and a paper donkey's head out of a Christmas cracker, but it tore if you were not careful for Bottom. Una was Titania with a wreath of columbines and a foxglove wand. The theater lay in a meadow called the Long Slip, a little mill stream carrying water to a mill 2 or 3 fields away, bent round one corner of it, and in the middle of the bend lay a large old fairy ring of darkened grass, which was the stage. The millstream banks, overgrown with willow, hazel, and guelder rose, made convenient places to wait until your turn came. And a grown-up who had seen it said that Shakespeare himself could not have imagined a more suitable setting for his play. They were not, of course, allowed to act on Midsummer Night itself, but they went down after tea on Midsummer Eve, when the shadows were growing, and they took their supper with them, hard-boiled eggs, Bath Oliver biscuits, and salt in an envelope. The three cows had been milked and were grazing steadily with a tearing noise that one could hear all down the meadow. And the noise of the mill at work sounded like bare feet running on hard ground. A cuckoo sat on a gatepost singing his broken June tune, Cuckoo Cuck, while a busy kingfisher crossed from the millstream to the brook which ran on the other side of the meadow. Everything else was a sort of thick, sleepy stillness, smelling of meadow sweet and dry grass. Their play went beautifully. Dan remembered all his parts, Puck, Bottom, and the three fairies. And Una never forgot a word of Titania, not even the difficult piece where she tells the fairies how to feed Bottom with apricots, ripe figs, and dewberries. And all the lines end in ease. They were both so pleased that they acted it 3 times over from beginning to end before they sat down in the unthistly center of the ring to eat eggs and Bath Olivers. This was when they heard a whistle among the alders on the bank, and they jumped. The bushes parted. In the very spot where Dan had stood as Puck, they saw a small, brown, broad-shouldered, pointy-eared person with a snub nose, slanting blue eyes, and a grin that ran right across his freckled face. He shaded his forehead as though he were watching Quint, Snout, Bottom, and the others rehearsing Pyramus and Thisbe. And in a voice as deep as three cows asking to be milked, he began, "What hempen homespuns have we swaggering here so near the cradle of our fairy queen?" He stopped, hollowed one hand round his ear, and with a wicked twinkle in his eye went on, "What? A play toward? I'll be auditor, an actor too, perhaps, if I see cause." The children looked and gasped. The small thing, he was no taller than Dan's shoulder, stepped quietly into the ring. "I'm rather out of practice," said he, "but that's the way my part ought to be played." Still, the children stared at him, from his dark blue cap like a big columbine flower to his bare, hairy feet. At last, he laughed. "Please don't look like that. It isn't my fault. What else could you expect?" he said. "We didn't expect anyone," Dan answered slowly. "This is our field." "Is it?" said their visitor, sitting down. "Then what on human earth made you act Midsummer Night's Dream 3 times over on Midsummer's Eve in the middle of a ring and under, right under one of my oldest hills in old England?" "Pook's Hill? Puck's Hill? Puck's Hill? Pook's Hill? It's as plain as the nose on my face." He pointed to the bare, fern-covered slope of Pook's Hill that runs up from the far side of the millstream to a dark wood. Beyond that wood, the ground rises and rises for 500 feet, till at last you climb out on the bare top of Beacon Hill. "By oak, ash, and thorn," he cried, still laughing. "If this had happened a few hundred years ago, you'd have had all the people of the hills out like bees in June." "We didn't know it was wrong," said Dan.
"Wrong?" The little fellow shook with laughter.
"Indeed, it isn't wrong. You've done something that kings and knights and scholars in old days would have given their crowns and spurs and books to find out. If Merlin himself had helped you, you could not have managed better. You've broken the hills. You've broken the hills. It hasn't happened in 1,000 years.
We didn't mean to," said Una.
"Of course you didn't. That's just why you did it. Unluckily, the hills are empty now, and all the people of the hills are gone. I'm the only one left. I'm Puck, the oldest thing in England.
Very much at your service, if you care to have anything to do with me. If you don't, of course, you've only to say so, and I'll go." He looked at the children, and the children looked at him for quite half a minute. His eyes did not twinkle anymore. They were very kind, and there was the beginning of a good smile on his lips. Una put out her hand.
"Don't go," she said. "We like you."
"I have a Bath Oliver biscuit," said Dan, and he passed over the squashy envelope with the eggs.
"By oak, ash, and thorn," cried Puck, taking off his blue cap. "I like you, too."
"I love that book."
"And Gelder Rose is a lovely name for a bush, don't you think?" "Guess what? It's pretty much the American cranberry, the American high bush cranberry, genetically so close that the two can easily crossbreed. And the berries of both have the same near-magical effects on health, too. Like the musical soundscapes you hear on this program by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Good for what ails ya. Since time out of mind, Gelder Rose has been taken by mothers-to-be. The bark is often brewed into a tea, as its anti-spasm properties help prevent premature labor and even miscarriage. It was commonly taken by women to lessen monthly cramps, too. Still is, by those who know. And that's how its nickname, Cramp Bark, came to be. Some recent studies have even shown that cramp bark is a good treatment for endometriosis. And the whole plant is full of antioxidants. People have taken it to lower their blood pressure and to get to sleep at night. Another miracle plant. Again, the American cranberry bush has basically the same properties, which is why real cranberry juice is the go-to cure for a UTI, a urinary tract infection. I've seen another study that reported garden variety Gelder Rose slowed or reduced tumors, in rats at least. But we are so much like the rat. We don't see cranberries in the produce section until autumn because Americans tend to ignore the cranberry until Christmas or Thanksgiving or a UTI. But I love them, so when those bags of organic cranberries show up, I fill up the basket, freeze the ones I'm not using for my world-famous real cranberry business I cook up for the harvest and wintertime dinners. The recipe really is world famous, as I've received mail from around the world about it, praising the ease and tastiness, mostly from the U.S. and Canada.
but all saying how everybody likes the real cranberry business. About 15 years ago, when I was working for this politics blog, I posted my Thanksgiving recipe, and a lot of people had no idea cranberry sauce could exist outside of a can. It's so easy to make, I might be able to tell you in the few moments we have left. Settle down, coyotes. Real cranberry sauce cold from the fridge is one of the best things you can put on a cold lunch plate or add to a sandwich in the hot, hot months of summertime. Slice up some equally cold roasted turkey, stack up some leaf lettuce, etc., then slather a bunch of cranberry business on top, all between a couple of big slices of lightly toasted sheep herder's bread from Bishop. And that's how you beat the summertime sadness. Two bags of fresh cranberries, wash them, dump them in a Pyrex baking dish, and with a regular old cheese grater, grate off about 3 tablespoons worth of orange peel from the big orange you brought home with the cranberries. This is a frontier version of what the chefs call zest. You want to see the slivers of orange peel. It adds color, orange color. That means it's a good food. Now squeeze the juice from that very same orange, the pulp, everything, all over your cranberries. Go easy on the sugar. It doesn't need 2 or 3 cups of sugar. I usually use 1 cup organic brown cane sugar. And then about 3 generous shots of Kentucky bourbon or Tennessee whiskey, that's fine. Some fresh nutmeg and a little cinnamon. Cover your casserole dish, put it in the oven, 300, maybe a half hour. You can make it in a saucepan. When it's hot, you don't want to heat the whole house up with the oven. Make sure it's your correct level of tartness. Put it in the fridge. Goes good with everything. You can make a peanut butter and cranberry sauce sandwich. Put it in a canning jar and it'll keep in the fridge for a good long time. Thanks for all your orders on DesertOracle.com. I think I got everything mailed out, save for whatever came in today. And thanks for supporting the show, the broadcast, at patreon.com/DesertOracle. From Amboy to Zyzix and across the Mojave Wilderness, this has been Desert Oracle Radio, Summer Solstice Full Moon Edition 2024. Boy, that moon is big outside. Good night from the Voice of the Desert.